And now a look at local and statewide news. The Kodiak City Council last night advanced a public hearing two ordinances, one of which deals with edible marijuana products, the other online sales tax. KMXT's Maggie Wall has more.
The two ordinances will go to public hearing at the next City Council meeting, where at least the marijuana edibles one is expected to draw a number of comments from both sides of the issue. The first would advance the city of Kodiak a few steps closer to collecting sales tax on online purchases. The city and other local governments are working together to form a single body for online tax collection. The other ordinance would allow the sale of marijuana edibles within the city limits. While there were no official public hearings last night, two audience members took advantage of the citizens' comments period near the beginning of the meeting to express their opposition to the measure. Kent Cross said he's concerned about health issues related to marijuana.
Marijuana is bad for the individual and it's bad for the community, the use of it. And you don't take my word for it. Go to the National Institute of Health. They're nonpartisan. It's a government agency. Read what they have to say. Just Google marijuana edible safety and all kinds of information will come up.
He added that he has no problem with people using marijuana for medicinal purposes with a doctor's prescription. Before voting to advance the ordinance, Councilmember John Whidden said he has no issue with adults smoking pot or eating edible marijuana products. But he is concerned that kids, especially young ones, could end up ingesting edibles by mistaking it for food or candy.
And I've had that concern voiced to me by numerous people. I did do some research. I visited the marijuana retail shops here in Kodiak, and I also went to one in Juneau and looked at what they sell. And there's nothing that looks like a known product that we would sell, let's say, at a candy store. However, I think to somebody who's younger, food is food, and if it's in a readily accessible, I think they're probably going to grab a hold of it.
Whidden suggested that if the council ultimately allows the sale of edibles, that the city should consider an educational campaign to help children understand what they look like and why they should be avoided. Councilmember Terry Haynes said he supports the measure.
Well, I'd just like to point out that we shouldn't hold marijuana to a higher standard than anything else that's legal, because the fact is it is legal. And I think that people like my mother should be able to have access to things that treat her pain in a way that's much less, has many fewer side effects than everything else she's ever used. The other thing I'd like to point out is that folks say, well, if you want to have edibles, you can make your own. But the fact is that if you make your own edibles, you don't know what that dosage is now. And edibles right now are made under a testing system where you know exactly how much is in that every edible. And it's the responsibility of everyone. You know, if it's legal, it's your responsibility to keep it out of the reach of children, whether it's pills, alcohol, or any other thing that's legal and on our shelves already.
The final vote on whether or not to allow selling marijuana edibles inside the city is expected to come up following a public hearing at the next council meeting. For KMXT News, I'm Maggie Wall.
The Kodiak City Council last night also honored the passing of two pillars of the community. Dr. Bob Johnson died on January 31st, and Coach Joe Floyd passed away last weekend. Mayor Pat Branson lost her voice as she started the comments, as did Councilmember Terry Haynes, who was the last to comment.
Finally, we lost two Kodiak legends this month, Dr. Bob and Joe Floyd, and I didn't think I'd tear up. Just special people. They made the community better, and each of us better as well. We'll miss them.
Two legends indeed that were lost and will be greatly missed. They made such an impact in this community, and something we could all learn from them is we could all learn a lot from them, and just a lot of people idolize them, so they will be greatly missed. And thankfully, their families are still here, and we have people to look up to now that they're not here.
I'd also like to express my condolences to the Johnson family and to the Floyd family. And probably the best way I can sum up both of those gentlemen who just left us is their absolute dedication to Kodiak and both the children and also just the community as a whole. And without either one of them, this Kodiak would be a lesser place for it. So they leave a legacy that we'll live with for many, many, many years. So thank you for them, and just blessings to the families.
Yes, we did. We lost two pillars to our community recently, Dr. Bob and Mr. Joe Floyd, or Coach as they called him. Both contributed greatly to our community and making it is what it is today.
I'd also like to extend my condolences to the Johnson and Floyd families. My prayers go out to you guys.
Yes, our prayers are with the families of Coach Joe Floyd and Dr. Bob Johnson. They're longtime supporters of Kodiak and our families, and they'll be sorely missed.
I want to say that Dr. Bob and Coach Floyd, shoot, man, you got me going, man, Mayor.
Sorry, I lost it.
They represent the best of us. You know, I think they represented Kodiak. I got the honor of getting to know Coach Floyd as the husband of Mayor Floyd. And, I mean, anyone who knows Coach Floyd knows what I mean. I mean, what a fine fellow. I watched him walk through the security at the airport once, and all the bells and whistles started going off. Everything's like, whoop, whoop, whoop. And they're like, what, Coach Floyd, what do you got going there? He goes, well, I do have this pacemaker going. He's like, well, no, you can't do that. You could drop dead. You can't just walk through what he thinks of the pacemaker. But it was just an honor to know him. And I can't say enough about Dr. Bob. What can you say? So just thank you to both of you fine gentlemen.
City Mayor and Kodiak City Council members sharing thoughts of Dr. Bob Johnson and Coach Joe Floyd, icons of the community who passed away within a month of each other. Cook Inlet beluga whales are continuing to decline in number, according to a NOAA abundance estimate released last month. The decline of the white whales has been going on for decades. In the 1970s, they numbered around 1,400. In 2008, Cook Inlet belugas were listed as endangered, and still numbers continue to drop. Today, there are less than 300 belugas in Cook Inlet. Still, the reason why they're disappearing are still largely a mystery to researchers.
It's such a frustration to not be able to really understand why the population is not recovering. So we are just stuck with hypotheses that we really cannot yet prove or disprove.
That's Paul Wade, a NOAA researcher who has done aerial surveys of Cook Inlet belugas since the 1990s. He and other researchers have a number of theories for why they're disappearing, from direct human interaction to climate change disrupting their food source.
And I think the reduction in prey has become something that we have a little more concern and want more information about, given declines in salmon in Alaska, including some of the salmon runs in Cook Inlet. It worries us that might be something affecting them.
Another possible factor is the high level of noise in a heavily trafficked area like Cook Inlet. Everything from boat engines to aircrafts overhead can interfere with beluga's echolocation. Wade says that can make it harder for them to find prey and may prevent them from entering certain parts of their habitat. A loud environment can also make it difficult for a calf to call for its mother, potentially separating a young whale from its mom, he says. Part of the reason scientists haven't been able to narrow down the reasons for the Cook Inlet beluga decline is that they're very difficult to study. Cook Inlet has silty, opaque water that makes the whales difficult to photograph. Much of Cook Inlet beluga research has to be done from the air. Even studying washed-up belugas is tricky, since many parts of Cook Inlet are difficult to reach. It's rare to get a sample that's fresh enough to determine cause of death. Kathy Burek is a veterinary pathologist based in Anchorage. She remembers studying one beluga that died from choking on a flounder, but beyond that, she says, it's hard to remember any with a distinct cause of death.
Whales get rotten really fast, and once they start getting rotten, you can't do a lot of the testing that you do to see if they died of an infectious disease or, you know, a lot of this stuff gets covered up when they're scavenging and rotting. So the vast majority of time, I don't know why they died.
Cook Inlet belugas are a genetically distinct population, separated from the nearest other cluster of Alaskan belugas in Bristol Bay by hundreds of miles. Wade says that if this population were to go extinct, it's very unlikely that other white whales would swim over to take their place. NOAA has an ongoing acoustic monitoring effort to study beluga movements in Cook Inlet and try to explain the decline. The next aerial survey is scheduled for this summer. The near shutdown of the Alaska Marine Highway System has been a boon for private sector barges, but as KHNS's Claire Strumpel reports, it's costing the state and private citizens a lot more to ship vehicles compared to the ferry.
Alaska Marine Line's barges to Haines are usually full of commercial freight, like groceries and building supplies.
Typical, we would usually move maybe, you know, 1 to 3 vehicles a week.
But AML's service center manager, Michael Ganey in Haines, says that after regional ferry service shut down in January, that number skyrocketed.
The first couple of weeks after the ferry situation started, we sent out about 24 and we had 30-something come in that same week. So it was a huge upswing.
Since the legislators were headed to session when the Matanuska broke down, the state was on the hook to pay to barge 21 vehicles out of Haines. Legislative Affairs says the total cost, including shifting parked cars from the state's ferry dock to the AML dock, was nearly $18,000. That's roughly 6 times more expensive than if the Alaska Marine Highway System was running. It was stressful for lawmakers.
I want to start by saying I am fully aware that my problems are nothing compared to what people are experiencing in communities with real life and safety issues.
Garen Tarr is a Democratic representative from Anchorage. Her vehicle was stuck in Haines for nearly 3 weeks. She says she's worked in Juneau for more than 2 decades as a legislative aide and nature guide. She's used to travel delays in Southeast.
Never before has something like this happened. And I think that's really significant that we have to recognize we have gotten to this place that's unprecedented in terms of lack of service.
The state paid for her and others' rental cars. So there's another added expense. Still, her luggage for the months-long legislative session was in her car's trunk in Haines. She says her friends in the legislature came through.
So I'm not really in a position where I wanted to or really could just go replace everything I own. And people were really fun and generous. And I'd come to work and there'd be some socks on the desk that someone had dropped off for me.
The pace of vehicle shipment in and out of Haines has slowed somewhat. But AML's Michael Ganey says it's still more than before when there were regular ferries.
Now we're kind of trickled off a little bit. We're moving maybe 4 or 5 a week each direction.
So still about double.
Yeah, still about double.
That's good business for private carriers like AML. But for regular people, the barge fare is several times the cost of the ferry. And it takes several days to claim your car or truck on the other end. Reporting in Haines, I'm Claire Strumpel.
The history of housing discrimination in Anchorage is murky. For decades, Black and Alaska Native residents were barred from buying or renting homes in most neighborhoods of the growing city through a combination of formal and informal means. One of the most pervasive were restrictive covenants on the deeds of a property that forbade selling to minorities. Though no longer legal, thousands of homes across Anchorage still technically have discriminatory covenants on the books. Now, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the Assembly is trying to figure out what to do about them.
Richard Watts was just 3 years old when his father moved the family from Philadelphia to Anchorage in the winter of 1949.
And he had heard about this place called Alaska where you could make some money and you had to work for it, but there was jobs available.
Now in his 70s, Watts lives in a house on the hillside that he designed himself before retiring from a long career working for local grocery retailer Kars. His family came up at a time when federal investment was pouring into Anchorage and builders were needed to expand nearby military bases. The population boomed and it was hard finding housing, even more so for the expanding number of Black workers and their families. The Watts found a place downtown where there was a cluster of Black businesses and families.
Right there where Office Max is right now. Right, if you go in Office Max's front door, that's probably where our house was.
From the boom years after World War II into the 60s, most of Anchorage's Black community lived in the neighborhood known today as Fairview, which at one point included an unincorporated portion known as East Chester Flats. According to municipal figures, in the mid-50s, Anchorage's population was approaching 35,000, and about 1/6 of its residents were Black, almost all of whom lived in the flats, with some others scattered through downtown and homesteads in what's now called Midtown.
There was no housing development in Anchorage that a Black could live in.
Watts says that with a few exceptions, Black and Alaska Native residents were confined to just one part of town.
One thing about discrimination in Anchorage, Alaska versus discrimination in Lower 48, in Lower 48, it was in your face. In Anchorage, Alaska, was hidden.
But one policy that's still evident, even decades later, is the restrictive covenants attached to houses and developments in neighborhoods all over Anchorage.
Sand Lake, Spinard, South Addition, North Star, parts of Fairview, Rogers Park, Airport Heights, Nunaka Valley.
David Reamer is a historian in Anchorage and says he's looked through hundreds of deeds that include discriminatory covenants barring the sale of homes to anyone who wasn't white.
And I found an expansion of these that matched the population expansion in Anchorage itself. There wasn't a real Black population in Anchorage until the city itself expanded eightfold in the late 40s.
In addition to the actual deeds, Reamer and his co-author on a recently published historical article also did interviews with people who lived through the time period, and they found a number of 1980s cassette tape recordings of Black residents talking about race relations and housing discrimination.
I stopped to look at some property.
Many of them, like Osha Mae Curry, spoke about the same mix of tactics that kept Black residents from living where they wanted.
The man said flatly to me, "This property is not for sale to you." I said, "What do you mean, to me?" He said, "Well, you go to your people and buy property if you want property."
Another challenge was building supplies. There weren't many. A lot of the housing stock in the boom years was built by developers who had access to capital and financing. Joe Jackson was a realtor and says without sizable bank loans available, many minorities built or expanded their homes out of material scrounged from military bases and dumps. As a result, a lot of the housing stock was abysmal.
So it wasn't the kind of a house that you would call house. It was a shack, actually a crate that was shipped here with big parts in it for the Air Force.
Houses made of salvaged lumber, tar paper, and other cast-off materials didn't accrue much equity, so property ownership for many residents didn't translate to wealth or upward mobility. Reamer recently presented his research to members of the Anchorage Assembly, some of whom are formulating a measure to address all the covenants still in place. Assemblymember Meg Zolotel says right after hearing Reamer speak, she looked up the documents attached to her own home in Rogers Park and got a surprise.
It basically is one where it's not blatant, it's like hidden racism built into the covenant. It's worded in such a way that it's obvious that people of color are not welcome.
Zolotel says finding out her family's home is tied to such a contract was made all the more troubling by the fact that her daughter is Black. And even though the discriminatory parts of the covenant are no longer legally enforceable, Zolotel says policymakers need to figure out a way to address the town's historical record on racism and housing in a more concerted way.
I think we need to preserve the record. I think when you simply just go and correct the record to update it into current terms, you lose the historical perspective. I think it's good to know where did it happen in Anchorage? Who was marginalized?
Zolotel isn't sure exactly what shape the eventual assembly measure will take, but she wants local community councils representing neighborhoods across town to be part of the process. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Midday Report on KMXT is brought to you in part by Ardinger's Fine Furnishings, where you'll find the Simmons Dual Comfort Mattress, allowing you to customize your sleep experience. Also featuring massage and zero-gravity chairs from the Human Touch Company and sofas and love seats by Stanton. 486-5554.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. A first lawsuit and legislation are filed to stop plastic pollution. More after this.
Integrated Marine Systems is the leader in marine refrigeration in Alaska. Visit imspacific.com.
The first ever major lawsuit against plastic makers and a new proposed law both aim to stop plastics from clogging our oceans and waterways. A lawsuit was filed yesterday in California State Supreme Court against Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Clorox, Procter & Gamble, and other major companies for polluting waterways, coasts, and oceans with millions of tons of plastics. The lawsuit was filed by the Earth Island Institute and the Plastic Pollution Coalition. It claims violations of the State Consumers Legal Remedies Act, public nuisance, defective product liability, negligence, and failure to warn of the harms to humans and animals. The complaint claims the average person ingests nearly 5 grams of plastics each week, the equivalent of a credit card. It says plastics also alter the chemical composition of the ocean when it breaks apart into smaller pieces and releases toxic chemicals into the waters. Meanwhile, on February 11th, a group of congressional Democrats introduced the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act of 2020. The law would, among other things, hold corporations accountable for wasteful products, phase out single-use plastics, reduce wasteful packaging, and reform the nation's waste and recycling systems. Today, 14% of oil and 8% of gas is used to make petrochemicals, the feedstock of plastics. The International Energy Agency predicts that within 30 years, 50% of the growth in oil demand will be related to petrochemicals. That means we're extracting fossil fuels not for energy, but for things like plastic soda bottles that we use once. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by Ocean Beauty Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Fish Radio is supported in part by Joy Crafts, specializing in marine safety equipment. U.S. Coast Guard approved AMC instruction for commercial fishing vessel safety procedures and drills, serving Kodiak for over 25 years. 486-6293 at 445 Shahafka Circle.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
KMXT's Island Messenger, supported in part by the Kodiak Daily Mirror, your hometown newspaper since 1940. Now online at www.kodiakdailymirror.com.
Welcome to this noon edition of the Island Messenger. In Kodiak today, it's going to be sunny with a high near 33 degrees. Northwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight should be mostly clear with a low around 25. Today is the 28th of February. Sunrise this morning was at 8:08 a.m. Sunset tonight will be at 6:39 p.m. That's 10 hours and 31 minutes of daylight. 4 minutes, 58 seconds more than we got yesterday. The record high on this day was 51 degrees in 2014, and the record low was -4 in 1986. Looking at our tides for today, high tide will be coming in at 4:37 p.m., 6.93 feet. Low tide at 10:34 p.m., 1.42 feet. Over on the west side, high tides at 5:10 p.m., 12.92 feet, and low tide will be at 11:16 p.m., 2.23 feet. A few community announcements for today. Senior Citizens of Kodiak is holding a regular meeting today at 1 p.m. in the center's multipurpose room. That meeting is open to the public. You can call 486-6181 for more information. Tomorrow at the public library at 11 a.m. is Tagalog Storytime. All ages are welcome to enjoy a children's story and activity in Tagalog and English. The Kodiak Island Borough Solid Waste Advisory Board meets on Monday at 5:15 p.m. at the Fisheries Research Science Center room on Near Island. The monthly swab meetings are open to anyone interested in Kodiak's waste management issues. And that's all I have for you for today.
Island Byways is supported by Orion's Mountain Sports, specializing in high-quality clothing and equipment for hiking, climbing, and kayaking. Orion's Mountain Sports, located at 1247 Mill Bay Road. Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the February 28th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Man, what a gorgeous day it was on Thursday. Friday, too. Sunny skies, no wind to speak of, and warm. You can hear the snow melting, and it felt like spring. I hope you get out to enjoy these days when they come around, because, as we've learned this winter, it could be here today, gone tomorrow. Warm sunny days bring the temptation to get up into the hills to do some skiing, snowboarding, or snow machining. Be extra cautious when up there. The warming weather creates additional potential for avalanches. Steve Wilebski of Kaiser reported yesterday that the southeast slopes are sliding in this warm weather. There's already been at least one significant avalanche, so take precautions. Tell people where you're going, carry a locator device and rescue equipment, and travel with a buddy. As we progress into spring, the weather can bring more uncertain snow and avalanche conditions. This doesn't mean you shouldn't go out. You just need to be smart about where you go and when you go. Right now, steer clear of or be extra cautious on southeastern slopes. Last week, I talked about Venus and Cassiopeia, both of which continue to put on a beautiful show this week. You really can't miss Venus, that's shining brightly alongside the waxing new moon. A gorgeous sight in the evening sky from sunset on. Also in the night sky is Orion, one of my favorite constellations. You can see Orion from early evening, visible first in the south as the twilight fades. It's a beauty. Speaking of beautiful things, Kodiak has some amazing photographers, and several of them will be displaying their work at Flyby during the month of March. Check them out starting on Monday. You might see Kodiak in a new light. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.